So today I'm bringing you Tristan Labbé. That's definitely a name that's better said with a French accent. I'm not going to try. Tristan is French-Canadian. He's a product designer, head of design at Glide, and a colleague of mine, someone who I really admire and wanted to bring him on the podcast in these early stages of restarting this. So we, unfortunately, there were some microphone issues and there were some camera issues, all teething issues that I'm sure I'll iron out in future episodes. So thanks for your patience. We talked about a bunch of really interesting things, all related to design, obviously. We start with talking about Figma and its impact on the way that Tristan works and the way that it impacts the way that designers actually think. That extended into the way that tools impact the way that we work and that sort of interface between the way that we think and the way that the software helps us think. We talked, of course, about spatial computing and the different paradigms for designers, the evolution of designing apps for web and the gap between designing native and web apps and how that's kind of sort of closing and coming closer and whether there will ever be no distinction between them both. We talked about Tristan's way into product design, the balance of design and engineering, which he has a great balance of. The role of constraints in creativity is a topic that I've always been interested in, not just from the way that design tools sort of restrict us, but also the way that we design software to restrict users in a kind of empowering way. And Glide is a kind of use case or an example that we talk about there. We talk about design aesthetics and building trust into a design system, the process of product design and distilling down ideas. That's always been something that seemed very complex to me, and we dive into that a little bit. We of course look at some of Tristan's career and planning and just the general approach and skill set of a product designer. I admire Tristan a lot, particularly his mindset, how he's calm. You can't really get more grounded than Tristan. So I quizzed him on that and he didn't give loads away, but there are some nuggets. So hopefully one day I'll learn to be as cool and chilled as Tristan. So if you enjoy the interview, please reach out to me on X and or leave comments on whatever platform that you're listening on. And as always, thanks for listening. And here's Tristan Labbé.
So what is the most influential product in your life and how has it changed the way that you think?
Wow. Okay. Starting with the easy questions, Jack. I will say Figma right now. To no surprise, because it's been quite a big change in how I work. And it has everything I need to truly be 100% efficient in what I do. I will say Figma for the visual aspect of things, because it's my hammer, it's my chisel, but it's also my thinking tool. The Fig Jam on iPad is something I discovered quite recently, actually, and it's been amazing to just doodle in this infinite canvas, which not a lot of drawing apps have on iPads. That would be my answer.
So digging into that a bit more, if you think back to before the days of Figma and the way that you thought about software and design then, mm-hmm. compare it to now, what does Figma give you?
Live collaboration, which is not fully, we're not fully optimizing as a industry around yet, I think. Maybe smaller teams do, but there's always this sort of screenshotting and sharing in Slack. That happened quite a lot before. And I guess just having like the multiplayer aspect of things was the game changing feature of Figma. Web-based and multiplayer by default was a totally like paradigm shifting sort of feature that made. Before that, we were using Sketch mostly as an industry. It was more powerful on a lot of aspects, on the details. And I feel like Motion is living this sort of moment now with a few tools from After Effects. They're very powerful but clunky to get in and to share work around. Projects are much more elaborate now because of Figma. You can go much deeper into either the amount of things you plan around, like the amount of screens you actually design, because everything is much faster to put together. But also the amount of iterations you have and cycles you have with engineers reviewing stuff live and them being able to access the. What I love the most is when an engineer opens a Figma file in a Zoom meeting, because I work a lot directly with engineers. And yeah, that's the moment that it clicked for me when it first happened. And I was able to get someone look at the actual file in Figma. That changed the game. Things become much more fluid and faster, I guess.
So explain or contextualize dev mode, which is a new feature in Figma over the last year for people who...
Dev mode is a state. I would say it's a nice way for Figma to grow its usage in probably larger teams, but direct engineers I work directly with usually just have edit mode on because it's more convenient. You have everything. And I don't like to relegate engineers to dev mode only, just because sometimes they can actually, I'd love for an engineer to actually play around with stuff, although it's with auto layouts and Figma and all of these things. It gets quickly a little daunting to try to move a button because it doesn't just move where you expect it to be, but like all the layout shifts it away from it. It's container, but in general, yeah. Dev mode is a helpful, I guess, a mode to explore Figma files, but it's not like a game-changing thing, I think.
So is it just an early feature or is it really just a state, as you said?
No, it's not early anymore. It's early. It's early-ish. I think it's just gotten out of beta. I don't think it's I think it's like dev tools only seats cost less. So I think it's a pricing play on their part, which is pretty smart. But from my perspective, it doesn't really add much to the equation.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm probably asking the wrong questions here. What I'm thinking in the back of my mind is about like their recent acquisition of, what is it, Dynaboard, and you know, their relation to that kind of software building tool and whether they are on a route to that.
Yeah. Okay, you're asking potential dev mode. That's an interesting question. Yeah, you would think Framer and actual, not Framer, I was actually going to talk about Framer, but Figma, sort of play pretty close to what Framer is doing. They're both an editor, and Framer is actually a web web-based design tool that turns what you design into a website. Figma could easily do this. I don't know if they will, but it would make sense. And this Dynaboard, I think I haven't read much about it, but I think it touches on that potential idea of them letting people build stuff.
Mm-hmm. So just going back to that question about how Figma has changed the way that you think, just opening that up more generally just to computers, like it's a question that I'm really fascinated about. Maybe another way to phrase it would just say a story, which is that I remember when I was directing like a theater show when I was younger, the musical director said this thing, which has just stuck with me ever since. We were talking about Apple computers and I was saying how I use it all the time. And he was like, oh, I hate using it. And I was like, why? And he was like, I just hate the way it changes the way I think. And it just really struck with me that like software can change the way that you think. And that's always been a great thing for me. So I'm just interested if you have any reflections on that, about how software has changed the way that you think. And also, have you thought about the interplay of the way that interface and design is something that both changes the way that we think and also the way that we think changes the way that we design it?
It's a very interesting question. Well, first, I think tools leave their mark necessarily on software. So the state of software now is very Figma-driven, as it was Photoshop-driven 10 years ago and maybe Sketch-driven. Even if like the Apple, I think the Apple team still designs in Sketch because it's a little bit more, you have a little bit more control, but subtle details, like not being able, like just recently being able to add a stroke only on the bottom part of a rectangle in Figma, I think influenced the industry into not thinking about that and not using shadows as much and just having a border around everything or relying on drop shadows to only add it to the bottom. So it's these small quirks of like constraints that you have in the tool that do affect how you end up finding a solution, because there's often a few solutions to one problem, and the tool will guide you depending on its constraints to the solution you end up on. So that's for, I think, the first part of your question. And then do tools, so tools do influence in that. I don't know the first part, but yeah, tools do influence the way you think, especially as a designer. And the way you think is affected by your tools, for sure. I'm a more of a scrappy sort of space minded sort of brain, I guess. I've always loved using the very ugly default stickies app in macOS, and my friends made fun of me because of it, and they found it very strange that I liked having these post-its, very ugly looking post-its on my desktop, but they actually helped me group things, like in my mind. I know top left is for top of mind stuff and bottom right is for more long-term thinking, I guess. So I think there's a lot of this spatial aspect that the turn to mobile maybe skipped a little bit, but then with the return, the advent of VR, AR, I think is coming back a little bit more. And yeah, I love seeing tools. I think it's always been sort of the space, the screen itself is sort of the main medium, has always been a challenge to work with. And you have the usual constraints and usual methods of optimizing for it. But yeah, I love seeing tools that change this. And it all even happens on mobile. I was just using Amy, the new calendar app Amy on mobile, and they have this sort of split screen middle control that lets you sort of show things from the bottom. And it actually makes a lot of sense. Visually, it looks a little quirky initially, but I feel like this is going to be a common pattern that lets you optimize for, I guess, the larger phones we have nowadays, that you don't necessarily need to just see a calendar because you're on mobile. You can see your calendar and list of things at the bottom. So yeah, I'm quite excited about like the space and the industry exploring that, and me also with Light exploring that too.
Mm. Let's jump into that, actually. That was a segue I was going to find later with spatial computing. Are you excited about that? How are you thinking about it? And how do you think someone, you know, a company like Figma are thinking about this whole change? And is it important, or is it just a recurrence of a fad?
I don't know yet. I don't know enough about it yet, honestly, to give you a very insightful answer. All I know is that it's pretty hard still, especially with the Vision Pro, for developers to even develop for it. It's still the tooling and the SDK is not super friendly. Apple kept a tight wraps around access to it initially because it was sort of hidden. I think it will open up drastically in the next few months, and yeah, the space will change quite a bit. But it's not necessarily a space I'm particularly interested in exploring personally. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see it evolve, for sure.
Okay, so let's talk about a different kind of paradigm shift, which is like well-worn and been happening for a long time, but maybe we can think about it within like, so Arc Browser, right, has been around for how many years now? Like 2 years, making waves, doing really cool stuff. And I don't know how you would describe their mission or their belief, but one way to describe it would be that like apps and websites and everything is just going to be all in the same place online, and there will be no kind of distinction between between all of the different experiences. And so a browser is going to be the way that you experience everything, whether it's VR or a website. I guess my question is kind of like, how have you seen this change over the years? Do you think that, I guess, yeah, my question is about really the technology behind it. Could you, for a beginner, for someone who's not aware of the difference here, could just contextualize it and give a sense of where you see it going?
So I think there's two parts to it. Yes, the web technology, web-based software has evolved drastically in the last few years. Performance constraints changed. Before, it was much harder to build powerful, performant, web-based mobile apps, for example, because of the mobile device capacity to handle all these non-native, I guess, animations. And so you immediately got it that it wasn't native. I think that line is, this gap is closing quite a bit, but it will never be fully closed. I think there will always be a place for native apps and for web-based software. I think, I don't think it's, and going back to the VR thing, I think VR, there's a whole native aspect to it that you need to take into consideration. There's the beautiful design system that Apple built for their own version. There will probably be one for the many other potential worlds of VR OSs, I guess. So I think there will always be some sort of device optimized experience that will sort of push the boundaries. Web will always be constrained by web necessarily, because there are constraints that come with that. They can be, like I said, they can be bridged and they can be blurred a lot more. And I'm very hopeful for that future. But I think there will always be room for both.
Okay. So despite the constraints and the difference, what are some of the most exciting developments in web that you see coming or that are coming now that you're most inspired by?
Nothing in particular, apart from just the shift to acknowledging the relevance of web-based software now. That happened. It happened a while ago, I think a few years ago, but now it's becoming more mainstream, I guess, to consider web-based software as a viable solution. And a very viable one, a more viable one in most cases, versus native-based software, which is way more expensive to build and way harder because it requires specific knowledge. So, yeah, as an industry, I think we're living in a golden age of software. It's a beautiful time to be a product designer and a software engineer, because there's so much to we're sort of living into this. New era of there's so much to do, so much to build, and so many problems to solve through software. And web is now a very good solution, a very good method to solve those.
So let's take it back. What was the first time you noticed an interface and thought, that's gorgeous? How was it made? Like, do you remember that, or can you kind of guess when you thought that?
No, I don't remember it. I don't remember it, but I remember my early days of using Paint on the family computer, creating fake maps somehow. I loved creating fake maps, and I still have a love of maps, weirdly. But nothing in particular. I think playing video games, being exposed to the advent of internet, I think we were both sort of born at the same time the web was born. So we sort of grew up with it. It's been the first place I started learning to program in, like, as opposed to previous generations, which started with Flash, or like tools like CD-ROM builders, what's the director, Macromedia Director, or these types of sort of interactive or interaction design tools, I guess. Web just like started to be a true UI, I guess, interaction medium in the past 15 years, like 15 years ago-ish, maybe a bit more than that. Yeah, maybe 20 years. That's about when I started to really dive into design, considering that maybe I had the chance to become a designer, and that I could invest some time into learning the medium. But yeah, there's no one time specifically. It's really, I think, starting to use websites. And I started just when responsive websites were starting to become the norm, or the demand, like general demand, because mobile web was more accessible around like 2008. That was sort of an expertise that made me sort of combine my development knowledge, basic programming, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and merge that with my design interest, trying to make a job, like create a job, I guess, build projects on the web. And it didn't exist, like the product design title didn't exist back then. It wasn't a proper sort of job. It was always this sort of things design agency were doing on the side while doing pamphlets and print-based. So you had a lot of print-based designer applying their knowledge to web, but not a lot of just web native, I guess, designers like me. I think that shaped my whole sort of career. Being able to code a little bit and maximize the opportunities of the medium. CSS has its own constraints, its quirks, they're always changing, but much, much less in the recent years than it did back then. When I started rounded corners on things, on elements, buttons, and things like that were just starting to be available. Before that, you had to export the corners. So I'm sure if some old schoolers like me listen to this, they will remember those good days of splicing out a Photoshop file to get out the corners. And then you had all these shadows you needed to account for. So it was fun times back then to just try to make the most, again, of the medium. And it's always been the case. Like, nowadays, it's just performance software, animations, fluidity. This is still quite a high. There's still quite a lot more to do around those themes, and it's just a constant sort of challenge of keeping up to what's possible to do now with that sort of core medium.
So, design and engineering, would it be fair to say, have always been hand in hand? Like, there's not one before the other for you?
No. Yeah, hand in hand. Influences the other.
Do you see product designers who think primarily from one or the other? And does it kind of work that way?
No, I think there's valid reasons to just never touch code, and validity and designers not necessarily knowing everything about code. I know maybe a little bit more than the usual product designer, but I think it's really just about being aware of the constraints of the medium you're working with. And as long as you have that, if you know how to code or not, doesn't really matter. And I think now with these tools, like we were talking about Figma or Framer, even blurs this even more. The actual tool gives you the constraints. The toolbar on the right gives you limits to what you can do, but those limits are based on the web medium. And I'm not necessarily, never really been very stringent on this question of should designers code or not. I think it's really up to whatever, however you can deliver your ideas. And if you're aware of the constraints.
Mm-hmm. Constraints is a really interesting creative concept. I've always thought about it, or for a long time. I remember when I didn't think about it, I used to try and make sure that I was as free as possible and just started with a blank canvas. And actually, very early on, I realized setting those limits is the creativity, or at least the start of that creativity. When you are designing tools, and maybe you can bring in your thoughts about how we design Glide as well, how do you think about the power that you give users, or the power that you see other tools give users versus the freedom? Figma seems to me very open-ended with very little constraints, apart from maybe that you can't do a bottom border until recently. Whereas something like Glide is more on Rails, something like Webflow is more open, After Effects is open, jitters less. Yeah. I'd imagine you have a whole philosophy or thinking process around this.
I don't know if I have a whole philosophy. I think I have a thinking process, at least. It's really about giving people the right questions to ask themselves. And in Webflow and Figma, you can answer any question. You can have all the questions you want. Do I want to make my background white or black or gray or red? We don't ask you those questions in Glide. So it immediately gets you to the latter part and the more interesting part. We're sort of forcing you to focus on the right part of the process of creating software, which comes with its own sort of downsides or drawbacks of not having full control. But the main benefit is speed and end user experience, because you don't have as much possible scenarios. You can turn your you can build a lot of different apps with Glide, but they all have some sort of a Glide design sort of aesthetic and signature that preserves, hopefully preserves the end user, the ideal end user experience. But even there, and even then, there's still questions. We have a button component, and we see customers with more complex apps overuse this component, have screens with 20 buttons. How can you guide people? That's what I'm trying to think about a bit more now. It's guiding people into thinking about the end user experience, putting themselves in, talking to their users, having more empathy about how would a new user experience a very complex screen. And you can still make, ugly or less ideal user experiences in Glide, but at least it's a bit more, the floor is a little bit higher than you would with other tools like Webflow, I guess.
So there's two things I want to touch on there. One is how you get to that distillation of what the Glide design aesthetic is, as in the apps that get made. What causes you to update the design system for all apps? And is that just a sort of felt sense that any experienced designer is going to have if they're aware of the industry, or are there kind of places of inspiration or sources of information that you go to? How do you know it's time to deprecate that style and update it?
The primary value I have in mind for the design system of Glide, and even Glide itself, is trust, building trust for the end user that this software is, I can use this software in confidence. I have the confidence that it will help me do whatever process I need to go through. And that's what you sort of have, we take for granted with all these native apps that come with the phone, because of the aesthetic the actual OS has. The consistency is a big part of it. Gives you sort of a trust with the device you're using. makes you feel like you're doing the right things, basically. And as opposed to things that look a little bit off, maybe look not fluid enough, look clunky, they have these subliminal sort of meanings, I think, for people, even if people don't notice that we changed our title color from a slightly bluish dark gray to a pure black recently. I think they like the subliminal message is that this is on the same level as other native apps or other apps you're using. And yeah, I think that's the primary driver for now. But I think it's always sort of been a primary sort of value for software. So like it's always hard to build something that people will trust to use, and it comes with comes through different cues. Just that this the way your icon is styled is the first sort of touch point you have, and you need to be consistent across all of these touch points first and foremost. And after that, you can start being creative and start pushing the boundaries. But what we want to get to is this level of consistency that equals trust, I guess, for the end users.
Okay. And then the other point, which is maybe related, is about guiding the app designer, who you are, in a sense, restricting. As a tool gets more and more powerful, it has this tendency to add more features, more capabilities, and just endless forking of possibility. How do you kind of think about, I don't have the right word for it, controlling that, reining it in, guiding that? And where are you at right now with Glide in thinking about that?
You want to nudge people, I think, into maybe just warn them. Like right now we have a feature in Glide that lets you know if your accent color is not accessible when you select it. You can still change it and use the inaccessible one, but we at least like guard you to say, hey, maybe you should use another color. And I think it's really about that, like maybe prompting people to maybe rethink their decision, but also let them be also if they want to live with it. It's like there's a balance to find. We're a builder in a way, and we need to let people explore, and we might not be right on everything. So you need to leave it in the end to the builder to have full control. Otherwise, then you sort of lose the essence of what you're letting people create. Like they're here to. There's an aspirational aspect to having so much potential with this product. You don't want to shut that down with annoying like constraints. You want to sort of find the right constraints. And we've been thanked by customers, like users, like, thank you for reducing the amount of, like for changing the amount of options you have. I don't want to have so many design decisions to take. That comes back quite often as a feedback, funnily enough. And yeah, that's what, like, you want to make people think about the right things and make the right decisions and gently warn them, I think, when they're overusing certain colors or certain containers or certain components. So that's where I'm at in this question. Still have work to do on that front.
Yeah, camera failure there. Camera is too hot, so I'm going to switch to my webcam. So where were we with that question?
So you were asking me about how to reconcile user feedback, constraints, and all of that.
Yeah, the whole process of product design to me seems like an immense amount of information coming your way, and how do you distill that into the decisions that get made and then ultimately the features that get built?
I think it's a balance. It's a sort of a trifecta of user feedback, customer feedback, user interviews, being in touch with that, being in touch with the resources you have. So the actual team you have and the time you have to build whatever solution you might think of. And then the vision to balance both of these, like the feedback, the design vision, and the resources you have to come to a viable, feasible, and ideal solution, I guess, with what you have. So it's not always the it's probably not always the ideal solution in the proper like design, sort of design first approach. But yeah, building software is never really design first. I think it's design serves as a the glue to put all of these things together, so the vision and user context and resources. Yeah. So that's the primary, my primary challenge always is reconciling the three aspects. And I have, yes, I have some sort of say in the vision aspect of things, but I don't have much impact on the actual resources we have. And that's actually, maybe I have more now being more of a leadership and strategy level position, helps me sort of vouch for some ideas. And that's personally a challenge I find very interesting with companies our sizes, deciding what to do, where to focus, not spreading yourself too thin. And yeah, but still being in touch with what people think and understanding that, oh yeah, maybe now it's the right time to solve that issue because we have actually this other issue that connects to it. And we have this new solution that could sort of solve both. So these multiplier effect solutions, I find very interesting in products, complex products like ours, where you have some sort of a nucleus of an idea that can have ripple effect on few different aspects of your software, of the user experiences, and on the just the onboarding, also the getting to learn the software and getting to learn how to work with it.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about your career as a freelancer, you're also a founder, right, of a couple of things in the past that may or may not still be running. Are they still going?
Yeah,
or,
they're still going strong.
Right. Like looking back to your early days as a freelancer, comparing that now to your role as head of design at Glide, like what's the difference in your daily activity? Is it more like kind of just leadership and storytelling, or kind of like, yeah, like how do you, as opposed to actually designing the minutiae of everything and then implementing it, like what's the difference there for you?
I think even though it's two drastically different team size, we were four at the time, and now we're a lot more. It's very similar in a way. It's a lot of the same questions, and that's what I like the most about it, is that you're facing the reality, you have full agency on like what you need to do, as opposed to maybe very big. I work with different types of companies, from very large public companies to very small early stage startups. And that's why I like joining Glide at the stage it was at when I joined. It was still early, but there was the challenge was immense. And the mission is very motivating because it's sort of an never-ending problem that I'll be able to contribute to for a while. But yeah, the going back to the founder thing, I think I still have the same sort of spirit, I guess. One of my motto is being on fire, be on fire, as sort of a driver for pushing yourself to not ask too many questions sometimes, because as designers, we can fall into these traps quite often, and just try to stay on top of the things. It's a funny sort of quote, and the context for it is very funny, but yeah, I just love that the meaning it carries is like, don't take yourself too seriously, just move forward. Anything we build is ephemeral in a way, and you just need to try to best solve your problem the best way possible. And it's very similar to the my early days, and I learned so much by having that experience early. Very grateful for the time, for that period of my life.
Hmm. So with product design, there are features that you need to build now, like next month, in 6 months, and then there are visions for a year or two or 3 years down the line. Are you thinking about those now? Like, as someone who doesn't do any product design, it seems like a very hard problem to kind of like correlate all of those decisions, things you want to do in 2 years and what you put in place now and things that you have to do now to ship soon. Is that an issue for you now? Maybe it's not.
It's always an issue. You want to do everything now. like going back to this, the context, the resources, the time you have, like, it's always sort of, reassessing, keeping those problems close in your head. And there will come a moment where there will be an opportunity to solve it with something else. That's mainly how I think about it. It's like, yes, I'd love for Glide to be complete and to have all the aspects of it. But this complete state of Glide change always keeps changing. And I think it's the same in any product. Like the world keeps moving on and new constraints show up, new users show up with more demands or different use cases. And I wouldn't say it's a top problem, but it's a key challenge in like teams of our size and just design, product design in general, like being able to make the right decisions and make things happen at the right time.
I love the use of the word ephemeral for product design, everything or anything that you build indeed. Yeah. It's a really helpful thing to remind yourself of. And you strike me as always, whenever I speak to you, as someone who's very relaxed, even though you're someone who's doing a lot. And I'm just interested as to whether that has ever not been the case. Like, how have you seen your own mindset develop over the years?
For sure.
Have you ever not been this called out guy with a blue hat on?
Of course. I think it changes with experience. And I think one of the big paradox of our time is that when you're young, you think you don't have the chops, but when you're old, you think you don't. And when you're old, you think you don't have them anymore. And you're sort of trying to find a reconcile both cases in any creative field. I think we're all sort of living through these phases, and this middle state never seems to happen. You're either too young and don't have enough experience, or too old and washed up. So I guess I'm finding peace in like trying to think of myself as always in between these modes, like having a lot to learn still, but understanding that I do have experience and I can draw on it when the time is right. That's maybe how I try to reconcile it. I wouldn't say it's very rational like this in my mind. I do still have days that I think that I'm really bad at my job and shouldn't be doing it anymore. And I have highs, so it's still like highs and lows, but it just, I think it stabilizes with experience. And being aware of it and now trying to help people nurture that side of their work evolution in the design field, especially in creative fields in general, has been a big motivation point for me. Because it's always there's always going to be someone better than you, and just live with it, do your own thing, focus on what you do best, don't worry too much about building a statue of work that people will idolize. That's not reality. Reality is how you work with people and how can you do the best you can every day. And that's what I try and focus on.
So in the early days, how and even now, like, what's your approach to inspiration and your development as well? Like, are there skills you're trying to develop now consciously, or is it, or has that ever been the case, or does it just come from trying to build something and working out the next step to do it?
No, I do consciously, like early days, it was just about being able to translate what I was seeing. I think there's taste and there's craft to it. And the taste aspect is very important to nurture. That's something I try to keep up with. Honestly, as you grow older, I guess you have less time to wander around, and that's what I'm trying to protect more. Reserve time for it because it's important still. And on the craft aspect, in the early days, it's really about like learning about typography and just practice things every day and try to get better at executing your ideas with the tools you have. I'm still doing that, and I'm still learning on that front, like reconciling what I see, what I think we should, where would I glean from that I think would help us improve whatever a feature or the design system in general. But also like on the human aspect, what I like about working closely with still engineers and designers is that that we can sort of lift each other up in how we work daily together. And mentoring people into also, being the best version of themselves is something I'm trying to learn a bit more about now.
If you could have one matrix upload for a skill that you don't have right now, that has to be related to your career, what would it be?
So matrix upload, you mean like literally matrix as in a movie? Yeah, plug it in. I'd love to be great at Kung Fu. I don't know why, but there's something very appealing to it.
I did say professional.
Okay.
Tristan, I hope you heard that.
Professional skills. This is a.
Maybe you need that in product design. Maybe you need Kung Fu. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. No, it hasn't been really necessary so far. I hope not. But I think. I don't think there's any matrix upload. I won't try to find a insightful version of it. Honestly, I don't have any. I think you just need to be aware of your strengths and weaknesses, maybe, and focus on the strengths is what I would say. But I like in other fields, I would love to be great manually. If I wasn't doing what I do, I would try to build non-ephemeral things. Probably with wood. I've always loved, for some reason, looking at like following woodworking channels on YouTube, and to me that's I think it's common in people that do like stuff like us. When you work in digital world, you long for these the woods, the wooden furniture you could build, and the lasting houses you could put up, and I guess that would be that is the part of things that you need to reconcile yourself with, of like everything will always be changing, and I feel like the analogy I have for this is, I think our industry, I think motion is different. Motion, there's an artistic aspect, a stronger artist persona, I guess, that comes with it. That graphic design perhaps has more than product design, which is more technical, closer to maybe the industrial architecture sort of personas, where yes, you can have a style, but first and foremost, you just need to deliver a user experience, like a house where people can move in and understand where they need to go. Going back to the analogy, I think we're sort of in the early era of cinema, in the way like it was a whole new medium in the early 1900s. And I guess around 1940s, it started to become a little bit more of a real thing. real jobs. But you don't remember many movies from that era. And nowadays, like, movies change quite a bit. The way they're made has evolved, but the structure of it is still very much the same. Like, the process behind it is very much the same. There's way more people involved. It's a lot more... there's a lot more finesse needed to do them well. But I think we're still in these early days of a whole new medium that we've discovered 20, 30 something years ago. And maybe if you go back to software as a whole, maybe 1960s, but still it's changing so rapidly. It's evolving so quickly that you sort of need to come to terms with the ephemeral nature of it. To be happy, I guess, and content.
Cool. Thanks, Trist. I know you got to go, but I appreciate you coming on and having a chat. I'll have to do it again soon.
Yeah, sure. It's been great. Thanks for your deep questions, Jack. I would love to understand where you're at on some of these questions.
We'll have a coffee soon.
Yeah. I think it's...
Maybe you can start a podcast in all your free time.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I will have the Blue Hat podcast. Stay tuned. All right. Thanks, Jack.
All right, buddy. See ya.